So the time is now 8:33 a.m. on August 6, 2021, and I call the meeting of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom. The public and parties on this agenda have been properly noticed of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access instructions. Ms. Poe, would you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Present.
Dr. Davey?
Present.
Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Catarino?
Present.
Mr. Dinar?
Present.
Dr. Gill?
Present.
Ms. LeBoy? Dr. Marat?
Present.
Ms. Shreve?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you. Please note that the times stated on the agenda are approximate. The board makes every effort to begin proceedings at the scheduled time. The board may suspend the discussion of one agenda item, proceed to a timed item, and then return to a former agenda item at a later time. The board may also reorder non-timed items. The board does encourage everyone in attendance today to provide feedback by completing the board assessment form. You'll find the link on the meeting agenda that is posted to the board's website. I also want to take a moment to recognize board members for your hard work. Each board member spends several hours in preparation for these meetings. We greatly appreciate all of your time. We're excited to have a shorter meeting agenda. And so I know that everybody has probably gotten a much needed kind of reprieve from some of the reading and sorting through some of these materials, but those efforts still do not go unnoticed. So thank you guys so much for your time. I also wanted to acknowledge the efforts of board staff and our attorney. I know that this has been a long, going on 2 years now, and we are continuing to find more and more efficiencies. They have done a tremendous job in making our jobs easier, and we are greatly appreciative of that. I also wanted to take a moment to wish Krishna Poe a very happy birthday. Today is her birthday, so happy birthday to Krishna. Do we have any other comment? Oh, and then let me quickly make an announcement on continuing education credits. Attendance of this board meeting is eligible for continuing education credits. To receive credit, listen to the code words provided throughout the meeting. To repeat the code words to board staff for purposes of earning the CE credit, follow the link on the agenda on the form. Do we have any questions or comments from any board members? All right, hearing none. We will do the call to the public. Those wishing to address the board do not need to request permission in advance. However, the board will limit the number of persons speaking during this time to a reasonable number of any public comment manner. In addition, each person wishing to address the board will be given 3 minutes to do so. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.02H, the board can only take action on matters listed on the agenda. The board members may not discuss the matter with each other or with the members of the public addressing the board. The only option available is to instruct staff to place the topic on future meeting agenda, if applicable. Those wishing to speak, please unmute your line, state your name, and I will call on you. Ms. Pacnon, are we aware of any, do we have anybody?
Dr. Sherry Kraft. This is Dr. Marcy Haynes requesting permission to speak to the board.
So, Madam Chair, we have a Dr. Kraft and Dr. Haynes.
Perfect. Let's start with Dr. Kraft. You will have 3 minutes to address the board.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the board, thank you. My name is Dr. Sherry Kraft. I was granted a temporary license in psychology on August 14th, 2020. I currently work with underserved populations in the custody of Arizona Department of Corrections. I'd like to explain how the impact of the board's recent decision that in terms of us taking the ECCC Part 2 extends far beyond the temporary license holders and our families. The board's decision comes at a grave disservice to the community and patients we serve. with the inability of so many of us to continue in current employment positions or begin new ones, the underserved, marginalized, vulnerable populations we serve will be challenged at best in obtaining the care they need. They are able to if they're able to receive services at all. Three of us impacted by this ruling work in corrections, and many others work in community mental health sectors. The patients we serve in corrections in particular do not have the privilege nor option to seek out other licensed psychologists. These high-risk patients will be left to suffer without needed care, which is a direct violation of ethical and moral responsibilities to our patients. Treating the mental health needs of inmates before they transition into our local communities helps keep everyone safe. This ruling also significantly affects our current and prospective employers across Arizona, as many of us have signed contracts for employment to start this fall that we will now be unable to fulfill. The agencies and psychologists who are expecting us to be independently licensed will not be able to serve all those seeking services from them. I'm sorry to report to you that a common theme emerging out of the consultations we've had with our mentors and colleagues across various sectors of psychology, from academia to private practice to those in the public sector, is the question of whether we can rely on what the board says directly or through its staff. 8 months ago, when we received our letters in good faith, we had no reason to question the accuracy of these letters. We trusted in your written statements that we did not have to take the ECCC Part 2 as we moved from temporary license to full license. And that turned out to be true for some of our colleagues who were licensed without requiring the ECCC Part 2. But it has turned out to be a false statement to many of us who relied on what you'd said before, to our great detriment to take Part 2 after all. All of us, our patients and our prospective patients, are burdened by what we believe is a 180-degree change in the board's position. We would like to acknowledge that many unprecedented accommodations and workarounds were made available to allow more clinicians to practice during the COVID-19 pandemic. We understand this has been an overwhelming and uncertain time for many, including the board. Given we're still experiencing a worldwide pandemic at a time when Arizonians are in need of mental health services, we're asking you to work with us in finding a way to right what feels very much like a wrong. We're prepared to work with you on accommodations and workarounds to achieve our goals of full licensure in the earliest possible time. We ask you direct the board staff and its attorney to explore viable options with us. I appreciate you hearing us, or hearing me. Thank you for considering this request.
Thank you, Dr. Kraft. And the next speaker.
This is Dr. Haynes. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we are.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the board. I'm also a temporary license holder and have been in communication with the others of us over the past month since the board decision. We now respectfully provide the following new information on this matter. In the past week, Ms. Pakkinen has made us aware of the surprising information that 8 of our subset of temporary license holders have already applied and been granted full licensure earlier in 2021 without having passed the ECCC-2. We feel this information has particular significance, as it was not by accident these 8 people were allowed to license. It seems to reflect the intention of the board to include temporary license applicants in the initial decision. Intent was mirrored in 3 other documents this year. First, on a PDF document that has been on the board's website for the past year, stating that temporary license holders who had their temporary license application submitted before the deadline, but who failed to pass the ECCC-1 before that date, will not need to take the ECCC-2. Thus, one could conclude that temporary license holders would still be temporary license holders after the cutoff date if they had failed the exam, and therefore, they were also meant to be included in the initial decision. Second, board intent was shown on each of our ECCC score letters signed by the board that directed our next steps for applying for independent licensure now that we had passed the ECCC, stating, quote, if you wish to apply for independent licensure, please do so by using the standard psychological application for ECCC on our licensure. Since you have passed the ECCC, select the appropriate waiver option, end quote, thus clearly indicating we had met the requirement for licensure. And thirdly, board intent was shown in letters received from the board to each of us over the past year at time of temporary licensure, directly stating, quote, you are not required to take ECCC Part 2. What was not stated in these letters was that we would be required to meet current requirements at time of licensure application. We truly had no idea that we were not considered to be a part of the initial decision, And as one of the board members pointed out during the discussions, quote, they are going to be surprised, end quote. And yes, we were definitely surprised. The June board meeting was the very first time we had ever heard the licensure requirements could or would change for us, which has left many of us facing undue hardship, as plans have already been made professionally and personally based on the trust we put in the board's written communication to us over the past year. Had we been provided with adequate notice, we would have planned differently and not been in these predicaments currently. Given this new information, we would respectfully submit to you that a decision by the board to allow the remaining 17 of us to follow suit and license without having to pass the ECCC2 would not be considered arbitrary or capricious, but rather corrective and clarifying of an oversight. Ironically, what is arbitrary and inconsistent to us is allowing 8 of us to license without passing the ECCC2, while the other 17 are held to a different standard and are required to pass it in order to license. Additionally, it is arbitrary to us that it is such a big issue now, but was not at the time of the initial decision was made, nor at any time in between. Lastly, to clarify, we are not asking for the board to change the law found in the statutes. What we are respectfully requesting is that the board proceed with its initial idea to make an additional motion or policy statement or vote in order to either extend the date of November 1st, 2020, that is not in statute, or provide some other plausible solution as deemed appropriate by the board so as to include the remaining 17 of us and uphold the original understanding that has been communicated consistently to us for the past year, and in which a precedent has been set by the board's own actions in allowing 8 others from our small group to be fully licensed already. We are asking to be held to equivalent standards as our fellow peers and not to arbitrary last-minute changes, which inflict considerable undue hardship. We are asking the board to correct what was referred to by one of the board members as, quote, fundamentally unfair, end quote. We believe the board has our well-being in mind, and we appreciate continued action towards a reasonable and considerate resolution to this issue. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the board for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Hines. All right, we will now move to agenda item number 5, the board council's update. Ms. Galvin, do you have an update for us?
Briefly, good morning, members of the board. The update I have relates to Dr. Sade and her judicial review action filed in Superior Court. The oral argument has been set for September 12th, and I would expect a decision perhaps October or November, and we'll report that to you once it is received. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Galvin? Hearing none, we'll move to agenda item number 6, the consent agenda. For the record, are there any recusals for items on the consent agenda? A board member may request to remove an item from the consent agenda for independent discussion and action. Are there any such requests? Hearing none, do we have a motion to approve the items on the consent agenda?
A motion to approve.
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. All right, we have some time before our next timed items.
Madam Chair, we could go to agenda item number 9 for the self-report. The licensee and his attorney are present. Should be quick.
Perfect. We will now move to agenda item number 9, concerning a self-report by Dr. Timothy Cockler. Ms. Michelson, will you provide a summary to the board on this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Cockler has been a licensed psychologist in Arizona for approximately 9 years. He currently resides and practices in Utah, where he is also licensed as a psychologist. He is licensed in 4 other states as well. On July 1st, the licensee submitted a self-report by email indicating on June 10th of 2021, he had gone to the St. George Airport to catch a flight to visit a relative who was recently injured. When TSA was scanning his carry-on luggage, they discovered a handgun in the luggage. The licensee indicated in his self-report that he completely forgot the firearm was in his bag and that there was no intent to bring it on the airplane. He further reported that TSA contacted the local police department and that he was issued a citation by an officer in training. The licensee supplied a copy of the citation with his self-report, which indicated that the charge was a misdemeanor. The licensee indicated that he was advised by the district attorney that the charge was an infraction and not a misdemeanor as listed on the citation. The licensee submitted the police report and court documents upon my request in a timely manner. When I reviewed the statute listed on the citation and on the police report, which were the same, I did note that although this offense for possession of a firearm at an airport was a violation of Utah's criminal code, it was listed as an infraction, not a misdemeanor. Subsequent to this, on July 9th, the licensee and the prosecuting attorney signed a plea and abeyance agreement, which the court did approve a few days later. The agreement listed the violation as an infraction and indicated that the court will hold the plea in abeyance for 30 days. At the end of this period, the plea would be withdrawn and the charge would be dismissed if the licensee completed the following terms, which essentially was included paying a $160 fine. In a subsequent statement by the licensee's attorney, Dr. Akins, it was noted that Dr. Akins had suggested that the licensee self-report the charge to the board in an abundance of caution, given that there was only a limited time to self-report and that the initial citation incorrectly listed the charge as a misdemeanor. The statement also indicated that the charge was not reported to the other states where the licensee is licensed based on legal advice that had been previously obtained by the licensee. It was advised that he did not need to self-report in these states. Additionally, I want to note that although the licensee may not have been required to report the charge to the board under ARS 323208, which is the statute that addresses the requirement for reporting criminal charges, given that he was ultimately charged with an infraction and not a misdemeanor, the licensee still self-reported the information, so it must be reviewed by the board here today to determine what action, if any, should be taken in this matter. We do have Dr. Cochler and Dr. Akins present. Please let me know if there are any questions.
Thank you. Dr. Cochler and Dr. Akins, if you would like to introduce yourself and make a brief statement, you may do so now.
This is Dr. Akins, and I'm counsel for Dr. Cochler, and I'll let him introduce himself. And I know that time permitting, he has some brief comments to make to the board members today. By the way, happy birthday, Ms. Poe.
Thank you.
Dr. Cochler.
I'll second the motion on the happy birthday. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for allowing me to address this committee today. I've been anxious to explain the conduct that brings me before you today and hopefully lay this matter to rest. Back in June, I was flying out of the St. George, Utah Municipal Airport to Iowa to consult on a criminal case. Just that morning, I learned that my 96-year-old grandmother had just fallen and was not well. Without a second thought, I rushed out of my house with my office bags to catch my flight, preoccupied with the news of my grandmother. At airport security, TSA scanned my bag and found my handgun I sometimes carry in my office bag. The TSA agent approached me and asked what was in my luggage. I replied, my laptop and my testing equipment. The look on my face must have spoken volumes because he asked, is there anything else? I paused for the longest time, not knowing what else could be in my bag. And then it dawned on me, it must be my handgun. I was so embarrassed and apologized repeatedly to the TSA agent. He said not to worry, this kind of thing happens quite often. Much of my work as a psychologist involves work in criminal cases, and I have found it reassuring to own a weapon. I do have a permit to carry a concealed weapon in Utah, but obviously should not have had it in my carry-on luggage. Local law enforcement was called to the scene. I fully cooperated with the officers and explained the situation to them. The junior officer issued a citation, the gun was turned over to my wife, and I was free to leave. Following this event, I immediately called several individuals with the local district attorney's office, all of whom confirmed that the citation issued to me was for an infraction. I also sought input from one of the consultants from the trust as to whether or not I might have any ethical or professional responsibilities regarding the incident. The consultant did not believe my conduct constituted a reportable offense, but did give referrals to lawyers from each state in which I am licensed so that I could get specific legal advice. The advice given in all of the jurisdictions except for Arizona was that I did not need to self-report anything about the citation. Thus, no reports have been made to any boards other than Arizona. The advice given to me by the attorney referred to me in Arizona, Farron Akins, was that I should consider going ahead to make a self-report to the Arizona Licensing Board out of abundance of caution. This is because a citation issued to me listed misdemeanor as a severity of the offense. Dr. Akins explained that after reporting, I could clarify the matter to you, which I am now doing and have done in writing. If you examine the citation issued to me on June 10th at the airport, you'll note that the document lists the severity of the offense as a misdemeanor. However, the pinpoint cite for code section listed is for a lesser offense, that is an infraction. The difference between the two is the level of intent. A misdemeanor charge requires intentional conduct. An infraction involves conduct that is only negligent. I assure you that the misconduct in my case was entirely unintentional. Beyond what is listed in the citation document, there was never a charge of a misdemeanor lodged against me, only an infraction. This is shown by copies of the court docket, the court information sheet, and the plea and abeyance order that have been provided. The Washington County Justice Court docket definitely lists the charge as 7610-529-2AII, which is an infraction, as reported by the officer issuing the citation. In case there might be any thought that perhaps the original charge was for a misdemeanor, and somehow that was reduced by a plea bargain to an infraction, please let me clarify that this was simply not the case. The court information sheet and the plea agreement shown formalized as a plea and abeyance order both list a violation considered to be an infraction. No reduction in the severity of the charge was ever discussed or offered to me, and as it turns out, there never was a charge of a misdemeanor lodged against me. I do appreciate being able to explain this rather stupid mistake on my part. And to be clear, let me state that I assume full responsibility for my mistake. Please rest assured that I have taken measures to ensure this never happens again. This includes packing and unpacking my bag before leaving the house, placing a bright colored clip on the outside of the bag to serve as a visual cue to double check my bag, and purchasing a gun safe from my office. I respectfully ask that you take no further action on this matter and decline to open a formal complaint against me. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Cockler. Does anybody have any questions for the doctor or his attorney? Hearing none, the board will move into deliberations. Do we have any comments? Ms. Shreve?
Yeah, I don't see an infraction here or a violation of law. It is obviously an infraction mistake. We do appreciate you coming forward, at least and putting it forth to us and letting us have this discussion. Like you said, it was listed as a misdemeanor, but I think it's been clear now it's an infraction. So I don't see any issues moving forward.
Any additional comments?
Do we need a motion or?
I would prefer that there would be a motion, and if you are inclined not to open a complaint, then you could just make a motion to take no action. And I would clarify for the board that it's an infraction in Utah, even if it were a misdemeanor in Arizona, which I believe it is not a misdemeanor that constitutes moral turpitude that would result in an allegation of unprofessional conduct.
All right, then I'll make a motion that we take no action.
Seconded.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Dr. Cockler, thank you so much for joining us and for contacting us as quickly as possible. And we appreciate the steps that you put into place to mitigate this so it does not happen again for your own safety and well-being. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you all. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, board members. Signing off now.
Absolutely. All right. We still have just a couple minutes before timed item. Can we go ahead and see agenda item number 13? That's going to be discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding behavior analyst application for Krista McDiffitt-Leon. I am the lead board member for this item, so I will provide a summary. Ms. Leon submitted her application to the board with a converted number of hours for supervision from the intensive practicum to what would translate in behavior analysis as the independent field work. While that's acceptable by the BACB, our statute does require a full 1500 hours of experience. Ms. Leon did complete the hours that she was missing from that time and has supplied us with a document from her supervisor that she has met that deficiency. She has completed the additional hours and now does meet the state requirements for licensure. So I would move that we go ahead and approve her license.
I'll second it.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion does carry. We have, oh, good. The time is now 9 o'clock. We do have a timed item at 9 o'clock that we should be able to get to quickly. This is going to be the formal administrative hearing in the matter of Jeffrey Siegel, complaint number 2117, including findings of fact, conclusions of law, and orders as determined by the board. We have had change in information provided to us. Ms. Michelson, will you please provide us a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll make this brief. When this complaint was reviewed by the board at its meeting on June 4th, the board elected to proceed to a formal hearing in this matter at a later date, and also directed staff at that time that a consent agreement for the voluntary surrender of license would be acceptable in lieu of a formal hearing. It was noted by the board at that time that Mr. Siegel had been unresponsive during the complaint process and had failed to comply with a subpoena, among other issues. When the notice of hearing for today's meeting was sent to Mr. Siegel, which was sent back in June, a proposed consent agreement for the surrender of license was included for his consideration. This consent agreement was drafted by Ms. Galvin and I. I did not hear back from Mr. Siegel until yesterday morning. At that time, he sent me an email indicating that he had signed the consent agreement for surrender and had mailed it. Upon my request, he did send the signed signature page, which I did upload to the portal for the members' review. So at this point, the members can certainly, if they are in agreement with that consent agreement, they can approve that and vacate the formal hearing. As part of that motion, the board may want to consider notifying the BACB of this final action taken, as the board has typically in the past notified them of any non-disciplinary or disciplinary action. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Michelson. Do we have any questions or comments for Ms. Michelson? Hearing none, do we have a motion?
Madam Chair, this is Dr. Davey. I'll make the motion that we vacate the hearing and accept the agreement. And I would like to have included in this motion that the BAC be notified of this final action for this individual, for this case.
Thank you. Dr. Gill?
I have a quick question. Is there any remedies available to the supervisee in this case? Because she earned her hours. And she's just still going to suffer the consequences of a supervisor not being available to her documentation of her hours. Is there any remedy for her?
Dr. Gill, I believe that we were able to resolve that matter and approve her license.
That is correct. She has been issued her license since that time.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right. We do have a motion on the table.
We'll need a roll call.
I'll second the motion. Ms. Poe, will you please do a roll call?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Davis Wilson?
Yes.
Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
Yes.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
Yes.
Dr. Millar?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
Yes.
Vote is unanimous. Motion carries.
Thank you. We will now move to agenda item number 12. Agenda item number 12 is the discussion, consideration, possible action regarding EPPP only application and postdoctoral written training plan submitted with previous temporary license application from John Chaplesky. Dr. Meyer, will you please provide us an overview?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this agenda item is to review Dr. C's application to sit for the EPPP. A brief summary is that he initially applied for a temporary license and submitted a postdoctoral training plan, signed by Dr. Smith, who is a certified school psychologist and not a licensed psychologist. Dr. Smith does not meet the supervision requirements for Dr. C's application for licensure. Dr. C stated he mistakenly submitted the wrong training plan, as the training plan with Dr. Smith was for school psychology certification. Although previously Dr. Catarino pointed out that such a training plan is not required for certification as a school psychologist. Dr. C then submitted a new postdoctoral training plan for supervision under Dr. Mather, which ran from August 2020 to the end of July 2021. Since his postdoctoral hours were coming to an end, he changed his application from temporary licensure to sit for the EPPP. In our review of the training plans, it was unclear whether Dr. Smith or Dr. Mather had been providing clinical supervision and assuming clinical responsibility for Dr. C's work, as well as how the supervisory relationships were being explained to clients for informed consent. Dr. C and Dr. Mather reported that Dr. Mather was providing supervision and had clinical oversight of all of Dr. C's work, with Dr. Smith serving as a site supervisor at the school, American Leadership Academy. Drs. C and Mather were requested to submit documentation of supervision records and logs for the past year, as well as a contract with the school authorizing Dr. Mather's access to all student records for Dr. C's supervised experience. Documentation should also show that all of Dr. C's work was signed by Dr. Mather, and the supervision relationship was explained to students and parents as part of informed consent. Subsequent to last month's board meeting, Dr. C submitted supervision logs for the past year with Dr. Mather. However, no supervision notes were provided. An undated postdoctoral training agreement was also submitted that was signed by a representative from the school, stating that Dr. C was directly supervised at the school by Dr. Smith and is also under the direct supervision of Dr. Mather. The agreement stated that if parents have questions or concerns about Dr. C's work, they may first contact Dr. Smith, and if questions remain, they may contact Dr. Mather. The agreement does not address whether parents were provided information about the supervisory relationship, nor does it address whether Dr. Mather had access to clinical records or reviewed and signed all of the work performed by Dr. C. And this concludes the summary of the case.
Thank you, Dr. Mather. Dr. C, if you would like to introduce yourself and if you'd like to make a statement concerning your application, you may do so now.
Sure. Thank you again. My name is Dr. John Chaplesky. I just completed my postdoctoral resident under the supervision of Dr. John Mather. The reason that I'm here today is discuss, you know, the mistake I made regarding turning in the wrong application or the training agreement, the initial one I turned in from Dr. Smith was incorrect. And this kind of all of the questions that have stemmed from this have come from, a clerical error on my part, making a mistake, to which I take full responsibility for. But since then I've turned in, the correct application where stating that my clinical supervisor was Dr. Mather. So I'd be willing to answer any questions that come forth from this point on. So
I have a question.
Dr. Catarino?
I noticed in the supervision, it said there were some individual sessions and some group. Was there another intern at the site also?
Well, to clarify, I'm not an intern. There were no other interns.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a postdoc.
Realize that. I'm sorry.
There were others that participated in the group supervision, one of which was Dr. Smith. We collaborated on the work we did, the private practice as well, as the duties performed in the school setting. And also Dr. Woolrich, who is a licensed clinical psychologist, was present.
In group supervision, Dr. Smith and the other psych, Volvich, were both being supervised by Dr. Mather?
They were more there to provide their input on discussions or, topics being discussed.
Okay. Typically when I think group supervision, I think there are other people that are, there are other supervisees, in other words. And because it said sometimes that individual supervision, sometimes it said group supervision.
Okay. I was unaware of that clarification. With multiple people being there and providing, consultation and advice and whatnot, I classified it as group supervision. Either way, Dr. Mather and I were there and supervision was being provided. That was simply wrong wording, I guess, but the supervision was being provided.
I read the letter from the school and they said that the parents were given a verbal informed consent for the evaluation.
Yes.
So was there no written consent from the parents?
Like I said, we had discussed with the school, how we should go about doing that. And they stated that, a verbal notification, letting them know that, my status as a postdoctoral resident, as well as my on-site point of contact, Dr. Smith, and my clinical supervisor, Dr. Mather, who oversees all of my work. And they determined that that was sufficient.
It's two different questions. And the one question was the public informed of your role? And that was verbally, you say? And
yes.
Then when the parents were approached to have their child evaluated, it said that they were given informed consent for the evaluation just verbally.
Part of the MET process is that they provide permission to evaluate. That's one of the things that the parents need to sign before an evaluation can take place. So they were given verbal consent that, they were aware of my status as a postdoctoral resident, and also provided written permission to evaluate to start the evaluation process.
Okay, because on page five, they said something, just a verbal informed consent. They didn't mention that they were written forms for the evaluation.
That's not something that I provide as part of my postdoctoral resident. I believe that's pretty standard as far as the MET process goes, that permission to evaluate needs to be signed by, you know, guardians before an evaluation can take place.
Right. And I was concerned that the principal said it was just verbal. So like if there were in the files, for example, there would be a written form that the parents signed giving permission to evaluate.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so I'd like to go ahead and move this matter to a close. Dr. Sepleski is applying for permission to sit for the ECCC. In order to sit for the ECCC, he needs to have completed a pre-doctoral internship and earned a degree. He's met both of those criteria. You know, a couple of, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to do this or not, but just when you pass the exam and you have the opportunity to submit, you know, the postdoctoral form, because we actually don't have a postdoctoral form on file. He's explained his mistake. He submitted the wrong contract. We have the right one. So he's met that. When he completes his postdoc, then the postdoctoral form will be submitted. It's another opportunity for us to review it. Right now, based on his application, we're not reviewing his postdoctoral. We're only reviewing his agreement. Yesterday evening when I was reading it, I said, like, where's the postdoctoral? And then I realized that all we were doing was reviewing the agreement. Is the agreement acceptable? I think we have an explanation and it is acceptable. He's doing a valid postdoc. There's different experiences. He will submit the postdoctoral form. Dr. Mather will most likely complete that and submit it when he meets all his hours. Word of caution to Dr. Sepleski, and I know I'm saying your name wrong and I apologize. Remember that you need 1 hour of individual supervision for every 20 hours. The minute you throw in group, and if everyone in there is kind of part of your individual supervision, it's still individual supervision. You call it group, you don't meet, the postdoc doesn't meet the requirement. But right now, we're not reviewing a postdoc. We're only reviewing the agreement. So that's just a word of caution when you come back after you're done with your postdoc. You need one for every 20 hours of individual supervision. So I think we should go ahead and make a decision on, does he meet the requirements as stated by our statutes to sit for the ECCC? And because that's his request. And for the ECCC, he needs a degree, he needs a completed pre-doctoral, and he needs an agreement. He meets all three. So I make a motion that we approve his application.
I'll second the motion.
We have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Dr. Meyer?
So I agree with those requirements, but part of the application is to review that training agreement for postdoc. And we found issues with that. I agree that there's been a submission of a new plan, but I still see some questions about that. And so I also agree with Dr. Malott that we'll be reviewing those hours at another time. But the training plan and agreement is a part of this application, and that's where we've seen the issues. And so I would also like to move ahead and make a decision on this, but I don't know that we just want to ignore those concerns. I do have a couple of questions. Dr. C, did you, at one point in your application, you indicated that you had over 2,000 hours of pre-internship training hours. Do you have the training plan and ability to get verification of those pre-internship hours that could be applied for licensure?
I don't have them offhand, but what I can look and to see if I can get those. What I do know off the top of my head is that I completed well over the 2,000 hours of pre-internship. I did three pre-internship. I'm tongue-tied here. I did three pre-internship practicums, including a third one, which I volunteered for. It wasn't required by my program. And I know, you know, off the top of my head, during my first practicum placement, which was at Southwest Behavioral Health, that I accrued at least, if not more, than 2,000 hours. And that's not even including the additional two practicums that I completed.
And so one thought that I have is that for when you apply for licensure, you may want to consider the using the pre-internship hours and internship, because based on the current training plan, what we've seen, I don't know if the postdoctoral hours are going to be acceptable. But again, that can be determined later. For that to happen, I think we need to see that your reports and your work at the school were signed by Dr. Mather, who was taking full responsibility. The agreement that was submitted for this meeting doesn't say anything about access to records, or doesn't give any indication that your reports were signed by Dr. Mather. And so without that, I am concerned about the agreement that's currently in place for your postdoctoral training. That's all I wanted to say. But I'm fine with addressing the current motion.
Dr. Catarino, did you also have a comment? You are on mute.
On page 7, there was your signature and a list of the other supervisors. When was there's no signature? I hadn't seen that prior, and I didn't know when that was the date on. There's no date on that, and I just was wondering.
Could you give me some more information? I'm not quite sure.
I have down just page 7, and it lists your name and all your supervisors' names and who the hierarchy of supervision, but it doesn't have a date.
That is the letter from the school that you provided, Doctor.
Oh, okay. The agreement from the school. I apologize. There should have been a date on there. That was for my postdoctoral training. So during the time that I work with, Dr. Smith is my on-site point of contact, and Dr. Mather is my clinical supervisor. That was for the last year school year for us. So from that would have been August 2020 to the end of May 2021.
Dr. Shaklastri, when you come back, after you pass the exam and all those good things, and you may decide to use your pre-internship hours, I know you're part of the Argosy closure, if I'm not mistaken. But you all do use time to track, and,
yes,
there might be a possibility, and that would kind of make this a very clean, moving towards licensure. If that's not possible, you may want to do some addendums and make those clarification with dates, and that might help. I'm not making a determination one way or the other. It's, it will be a board review, but I'm just making some suggestions to help you along the way. So
thank you very much. And I will definitely take those into consideration.
Maybe even some of your reports. I know it gets very complicated in school psych, and I'm really interested in what the current pattern is, because students are working in this huge team effort, and how, who is ultimately submitting the report to the parent is complicated. And so when it does come back, I'll probably try to educate myself a little bit more so we can ask you some more. And you may want to do your own education and talk to other school sites in your position. So,
Dr. Ketter.
But I'd like to call the question. So,
what was the date of that paperwork on page 7?
There's no date.
I know. When was it done?
He said at the beginning of last school year.
I heard him say it was for last school year, but I don't know when they signed.
At the beginning of last school year.
At the beginning.
Yes.
Okay.
I did call the questions, so I think we need to.
Yes, so we do have a motion on the table and we do have a second. All in favor, please indicate so by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion does carry. I want to thank Dr. Smith for joining us. Dr. Mather, thank you so much for being available to us today. And Ms. McClellan, his legal counsel, thank you so much for being available today. We appreciate your guys' time.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
All right. Let's look at... Agenda item number 10, discussion, consideration, possible action regarding implementation of the out-of-state telehealth practice registry. Ms. Pakanon, can you please provide the board a summary on this matter?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just by way of reporting our progress for implementing the registry, I provided you with an update that's about a week old. We're only making what I would describe as incremental progress toward implementing the registry. We're still trying to identify the most appropriate way to operationalize the intake of the registry applications. It's not that we lack for options. We are just trying to identify the one that makes the most sense for us from an administrative perspective, both short-term and long-term. I am determined to do this as an online digital process as opposed to a paper-driven process. I do think that it is interesting that what I'm learning from the other boards is that while interest in the registry initially appeared to be quite high based on the number of inquiries that were coming to those boards, very few boards have had any applicants or a very small number of applicants for the registry. So there is some speculation that some of the requirements are just not palatable to out-of-state licensees, such as the requirement to have a liability insurance to practice in Arizona. So that's something that I think we'll continue to monitor over time. I think that as a precaution, as I submit the budget request for fiscal 23, what I am going to include is a request to increase our personnel services in order to serve as the intake and the administrative management of those applications. If we find that we don't need an increase in personnel, we don't have to exercise it. But I think that I want to secure that permissions because we simply don't know where we will be in a year or 18 months with the registry. Finally, I did attend a presentation on Wednesday. Christina Corrieri from the governor's office, who is a policy advisor and worked very hard on this legislation. She shared an update on this legislation with a broad group of interested individuals and stakeholders. The presentation mostly focused on payment and reimbursement issues. She did touch on the registry component of the legislation. And I didn't learn anything particularly new from that presentation, but it essentially affirmed what I understand to be true about this new program. So I am happy to answer any questions. I guess one more final comment, and I hope this is something that is clear. If we don't implement the registry until September, which is reflected by the new rules and the new fee September 1, I think that I think we're still serving the public effectively because we still have the temporary emergency application process in place. And so I'm reporting those numbers to you. We now exceed, I think, 580 psychologists with a temporary emergency license. We're still at 32 behavior analysts. So what I would like to see is a smooth transition, if we can, of those temporary emergency license holders to the registry, or in the case of the psychologist, they may wish to seek SIPACT interstate practice privileges, because that, of course, expands their practice opportunities beyond just Arizona. I'm happy to answer any questions about this topic.
Thank you, Ms. Pakanon. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Pakanon? Hearing none, thank you for your work on that and for your outreach to other jurisdictions to make sure that we are doing our due diligence. It's greatly appreciated. All right, we will move to agenda item number 11. Discussion, consideration, possible action regarding licensure and regulatory issues relative to COVID-19. Ms. Pakanon, will you please provide the board a summary?
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't have any updates to share with the board. I think that we are all aware that cases and hospitalizations and other data trends are going in the opposite direction that we have been experiencing for a number of months. To that end, we haven't heard any updates from any sources, in particular the governor's office, relative to the status of the state of emergency. I do continue to get inquiries from the temporary emergency license holders, and I do tell them that their licenses are still active, and it is in their best interest to stay informed of any announcements from our governor's office and to expect some communication from our office when we are aware of a status change. And I intend in that communication to also inform them of the options I just mentioned, SIPACT and the registry. So that is all I have to share.
Thank you. I have one question, and it's more so just pertaining to, because you're correct, I think that the trends that we're seeing are not favorable. At the last meeting, we discussed starting to explore and work on options for in-person meetings again. I'm curious, and if it's not something we can discuss now, maybe it's something we add to a future agenda, but I'm curious how much staff effort should be put into that at this time, or if we should kind of put that project on hold again until the numbers are trending in the correct decision. I would just hate for staff to continue to be doing work on something that's like pushing a rock up an uphill. I just think that it might be best that we consider, or the staff, of course, you guys can use your discretion on how quickly you report back to us on the status of in-person meetings by kind of putting that project on hold. I'd hate for you guys to do work that is not purposeful, but that's my only thought on that, and not sure if that's something you guys have considered.
Madam Chair, we've only discussed among the staff that, you know, we understand that the November meeting was the first meeting identified as the board to attempt to resume meeting in person. We haven't done any work toward attempting to implement a hybrid meeting strategy. We're still kind of waiting to see if other boards are successful with that approach or not. We do have some, as I articulated previously, some concerns about, you know, if technology fails, then the quorum fails and the meeting doesn't happen. So that's probably the greatest concern that we have. I think I speak for all the staff when I say that, you know, if you direct us to arrange for the meeting to be in person in November, we are fully prepared to do that. If it's the board's pleasure to hold off on that and push the next in-person meeting date out into the future, we are perfectly prepared to do that as well. So we will just take the board's direction.
Thank you. All right. I appreciate that update. I'm going to, and you guys can correct me. We only have three agenda items left, correct?
I think we just have one. And the last two.
Just two.
Okay. I would like to, if I could, call agenda item 14, and then we'll hold that agenda item for after the meeting as well. But agenda item number 14 is any future agenda items for future meetings. And I wanted to call that to see if we have any discussion on that now while we have some time. Again, we can discuss it again after the 10 o'clock item. But are there any?
Yeah, I have one. I think we do. I mean, I know we talked and made a decision last month, but I would like to see all the communication that temporary license holders receive from the board, you know, and so we can do maybe, I'd like to revisit it.
I would agree with that, just so that we can do a thorough review of all of the communication and what actions we've taken up to this point as well. I also would like to see on the next agenda just a spot again for those in-person meetings, because I think we'll have more information by then. We may need to make some decisions going into cold and flu season. We may need to make some changes to previous conversations that we've had. So I think we need to add back in there the resuming of in-person meetings. Any other, Dr. Meyer?
I'm not exactly sure how this works, but do we need to have an agenda to discuss reviewing the clinical supervision of a psychologist from another case to decide if we should open up a complaint? Does that need an agenda? Does that happen at just with the executive staff?
I believe anytime a board member, and Ms. Galvin can correct me if I'm wrong, anytime a board member or the board wishes to review a potential item that might be opening of a complaint, that would need to be an agenda item. So for example, we might say, I have concerns about behavior analyst Johnny Smith, and I would like to see that we review these concerns with an agenda item of potential opening of a complaint, and then at that point make a motion as to whether or not a complaint would be opened. But I do believe that that has to be on the agenda. Ms. Galvin?
That's correct.
Okay. So then I would like to add an agenda item to have a discussion about Dr. John Mather's supervision and whether that should be looked at further.
Ms. Shreve?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if this is an agenda item or just an administrative issue. One of the things that came to my attention in recent documents is the application that we use doesn't say temporary license as opposed to independent license. We use the same application, which I think is confusing to people. I think we need to identify, even though they're the same technically, that they should be headed differently. So it's clear that you're, you know, applying for temporary, you're applying for independent or whatever the license is, that it's clear you're not filling out one for everything, because that's basically we're using one application. So I don't know if that's an administrative matter that I can just ask for, or if we need to actually discuss that and approve it as a counts, as a group. Ms. Galvin, I don't know if you have a thought on that.
I think that is something that can be handled administratively. And I believe, Heidi, you may have already undertaken steps to make that change. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Ms. Galvin, yes. By virtue of the fact that we are going to an online system that will differentiate more clearly the application process or pathway that is under selection, yes, that's the ultimate fix. But we're taking care of just some administrative, you know, some adjustments to the PDF form that we currently use for intake.
All right, thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I may speak to a possible future agenda item, and Dr. Malott, I'm not sure if we're going to be entirely ready for September. It may be an October discussion, but I think the board members will remember the early entry EPPP proposal that ASPA brought to us a couple of months ago. A group of us have been meeting to discuss that. We're gathering some data from other states in particular, and from ASPPB. And there may be a companion piece to that as well that we think could present applicants with some form of a, I guess I'll call it an accommodation as it relates to reducing the reducing the burden to the applicant for applying for approval to take the ePPP, reducing their cost, and it also reducing the administrative burden to staff. So it's an idea that we're just starting to conceive, but I think we can bring these two matters, package them together, and bring them to you for discussion. I do believe they will require legislative change, so that will be part of your consideration.
I think we should add that, Ms. Pakenham, and at least even if we are not ready, explore our initial findings. So.
Thank you.
Or share our initial findings.
Excellent. Thank you. Dr. Catarino.
This is just an administrative thing, perhaps. I was looking to renew my fingerprint card, and they have, why do you want your fingerprint card? And they have education, foster parent, whatever, or physical therapist, but it doesn't have a licensed psychologist. Maybe somebody would like to contact the DPS and just have that as an option, if that's going to be required for us.
Yes, Madam Chair, I speculate when I respond to this, but I believe it's because the effective date of our bill is not until September 29th. I can see if there is any latitude to move that up so that as everyone prepares to comply with the new requirement, they see that. I don't know how successful I will be, but I will advocate for that change if I can. So we're obviously getting questions about the new requirement, which will be in effect January 1.
Or even if they have it on there in September, you know.
Or if they have an other category.
No, they didn't. They had other, and then the other went to foster parent, things like that. It didn't have.
I think I know when I've done it in the past, I've had to do it when you have hospital privileges and stuff. And so
there was a hospital.
There was a hospital. Okay. I can't remember. It's been a while. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Any, Dr. Gill?
I have a question for Ms. Pakenham. Once WUD passes the part one, how soon does the applicant then take part two? What's the time frame? And that time frame may change if we have an early entry for part one.
Ms. Galvin,
am I okay to answer that question?
I think if he's relating it back to your earlier meetings about reducing the burdens and whether there could be an early entry option, I'm okay with that.
Dr. Gill, I'm not sure I know the answer to that question because, up to this point, we had the beta test period for ACCC Part 2, then the blackout period, which I understand concludes August 15th. I know from an administrative perspective, the registration for both components of the examination can be done right away. In terms of the time frame between, I'm not aware that there is one, but I could defer to Ms. Folks if she is aware of one.
And just is the part two test, is that 4 hours long as well?
I do believe it is the same duration as part one.
Have to pass part one before you can sit for part two.
I understand that.
Yeah, so I think that is but how long does it take to schedule? I don't know.
Well, we're hearing all these comments about it puts a lot of pressure on the applicants and so forth. So I just wanted to get a clearer picture of the time frame between part one and part two. And so thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Diner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to mention an agenda item because we were on the topic. In one of the previous meetings, it had come to some of the board members' attention, and I think Dr. Malott had raised this issue, that in our statutes, we don't have a requirement for licensees to inform us of changed email addresses. So maybe we might need to look at a statutory change. So I just wanted to put that as an agenda item for future discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, I think we got the list. Okay, so what I'm going to do is a couple of things. One, I'm going to hold this agenda item and ask that Dr. Davey, after the complaint, if you'd like to just ask one more time if anybody has anything else to add, just in case something else comes up between now and the end of the meeting. And then what I'm going to do is suggest, since we have, since we can't start the 10 o'clock until 10, I'm going to suggest we do a recess until 10 o'clock. However, I am recused from the 10 o'clock matter. And so Dr. Davey will be taking that over. Dr. Davey, I know that you were prepared to take that matter over. If you wouldn't mind also taking over items 14 and 15 and adjournment, just because it's kind of silly to call me back in just to adjourn the meeting. But that is what I would recommend at this time. We go ahead and recess till 10 o'clock, and then Dr. Davey will be taking over the remainder of the meeting if that is okay with him.
That is okay with me. I don't want to have you come back just to make the adjournment.
I may purposely delay my re-entry just for fun.
Yes.
All right. Then we are recessed till 9:45. Everybody, thank you. Have a great day. Dr. Davey will take, or till 10 o'clock, I apologize. Dr. Davey will take over from here, and you guys have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know how accurate that is for everybody else's clock, but we'll go ahead and call that. So we are bringing back the Board of Psychologists board meeting into session. It is 10:01. We are going to move to timed item, discussion, consideration, possible action relating to an initial case review. So again, I'll restate that for board members. This is an initial case review of the following complaint. Complaint 2013, Brian Van Muerten, BCBA. The reason the initial case review is coming to the full board is that the individuals involved in this complaint are well known within the behavior analytic community, and therefore getting a quorum was proving difficult within the committee. And so therefore it's coming forward to the full board. With that as kind of a primer, we're going to move to item 8 concerning this matter. I am the lead for this case and will provide a brief summary to the board. Mr. Van Muerten was issued a behavior analytic license.
Davey Wilson. I just looked and saw who the complainants are. The complainants, sorry. Okay, I'm fine, sorry. I thought I know one of the parties pretty well. So I'm wondering whether I need to recuse myself. I just realized Dr. Davidson was a close colleague of mine. So,
And he is the complainant, Dr. Malott, but he's not a party to the proceedings.
Okay, so it's fine for me to be on. Okay. Okay, and I'm fine. I can be objective. I just saw his name on the complainant list, because I was focusing on the complaint and didn't notice the complainant's name, which I'm not supposed to mention, and I just mentioned.
Strike that from the record.
Dr. Davey, one quick point. It's complaint number 2113. I think you said 2013 on accident.
Apologize. Yep, I got multiple screens open.
Yeah,
one with your smiling face, one with the complaint, and one with my script. So we'll get that organized.
Thank you, sir.
So yes, complaint number 2113. All right, Mr. Van Muerten, any other discussion from the board before we get started on the review? Any other recusal issues?
Mr. Chair, if I may suggest, should we do a roll call since recusal and the number of board members is an issue?
I think we have quorum. We only really have Dr. Davis Wilson that's recused.
1, 2, 3, 4.
I can do another roll call if needed.
Yeah, go ahead. Since it was requested, I think that's fine, Krishna.
Thank you, Mr. Danner.
Dr. Davey.
Present.
Dr. Meyer.
Present.
Dr. Catarino.
You're on mute.
She's there.
Your eyes are moving.
Present.
Count.
Present.
Thank you. Mr. Dinar.
Present.
Dr. Gill.
Present.
Dr. Malat.
Present.
Ms. Shreve.
Present.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Thank you. I'll now move into an overview. Mr. Van Meerten was issued a behavior analyst license in BCBA or license in 2012. He is also a BCBA. Himself and another party in 2018 established a behavior analytic agency. The complainant joined that agency in late 2018 and moved up the ranks and became a member of the agency in 2019. Following 2019, the complainant then bought into the company by purchasing shares of one of the exiting members. 2020, November, Mr. Van Meerten, as well as the complainants, talked about the fact that he would resign from the agency. That he would, upon resignation, he would still be able to provide consultation services to the agency just to make sure that there was a smooth transition for the continuity of care for the members. There was an agreement signed on November 16th, 2020 that indicated that Mr. Van Meerten would go ahead and provide services for a 6 weeks period. There was a document that's included in the packet that identifies what's going to happen within the first 2 weeks, subsequent 2 weeks, and 2 weeks after that. Each of those which would initiate or completion of those sections would initiate a payment, culminating in a substantial amount of dollars being transacted over for the completion of that 6 week transition period. On December 21st, we have Mr. Van Meerten emailing the complainants, informing them that based on what he believed to be issues within the contract and contract being renegotiated, that he would be resigning effectively. The agency accepted that resignation. The complainants contend that Mr. Van Meerten chose to resign after the first 2 weeks and did not ensure proper transition. He failed to return some client files in his possession, and that he did not complete some clinical documentation for a number of individuals that he was responsible for. That completes my overview of the case. Is the complainant DD present? Go ahead. And if you are present, you are present.
I believe we have DD and KC co-complainant, but DD has to unmute his end. Oh, there we go.
I'm present.
Very good. Thank you, DD. And at this time, do you wish to make a statement to the board?
I think that our summary, our original complaint was succinct and to the point. I want to reiterate that we filed this complaint only because we believed it was our ethical violation, it was our ethical obligation to do so. We outlined the specific violations in our complaint that we believed were violated or by the loss of client files. So I don't really have anything more to add unless Ms. Callahan wants to do so.
I am present. Thank you, Dan. I don't have anything to add at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Do any of the board members have questions for the complainants, DD or KC, at this point? I have just a couple of questions that I just like some clarification on. That's in terms of the files, the box of files that are referenced in the report, DD and KC, you can track it through the text messages that were submitted as part of the complaint. So there's a text message at 8:50. The parties agree at 8:00 to meet at the office to exchange some files. paper files at this point. 857, Mr. Van Muren states that he has deposited those outside of your door 3 minutes prior to the arranged upon time, and departs, leaving those unaccounted for, you know, 3 minutes if you guys were there right at nine or sometime after that. Can you, inside some of the report, it talks about the fact that that door where those documents were left is not necessarily an outside door, that it's inside a building. Can you explain to us kind of the physical layout and where those documents were for that period of time?
Dr. Davey, members of the committee, yes, I can do that. The office is a one-story office with, I have not sure how many other offices within this building. It is locked from the outside from supposedly after 5 p.m. And every office inside, there's at least 20 different offices. Every office on the inside has their own key to get in. We all share an external key to get in the building. And the box was simply on the hallway in the floor outside our office.
So it's kind of like a suite complex, right? Like you have a locked door, you enter into it, you're inside a group of businesses, and then essentially it was left outside of your business door. And did Casey, you can respond to this since you were, I believe you were the party. Were you the individual that then arrived to retrieve the box? Or did Dee Dee get there first?
Thank you, Brent. I apologize for being off video. I have a newborn that I am with right now at the moment. So I believe Dan retrieved the box. Dan, will you correct me if I'm wrong? Yes.
I believe that's true. As soon as we got the text from Mr. Van Merton, we went in the back in the building and we found the box.
So, I mean, just an estimate, like you were there right around the 9 o'clock hour, so we didn't have it there sitting there for 2 days or over a long weekend.
Okay. That is correct. It was not there for a long length of time.
I appreciate that. Thank you. I just a couple of other questions, and it relates to documents you submitted, correct? So there's a substantial Excel spreadsheet that you provided that outlines clients' file review, record review, right? And so I'm wondering if you can discuss with me what that record review entailed and why we have kind of this discrepancy between the number of individuals that Mr. Van Muren was supervising, which I believe he would say was around 10, and why we have a document with about 50 people's names on it. So if you could just kind of maybe elaborate on that document, I would appreciate it.
Dr. Davey, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Ms. Callahan to answer questions about the files. And I'd like to join in also if I have anything to add.
Thank you. And if I ask the wrong one of you, please feel free to defer to the other.
That's totally fine, yes.
Thank you, Dan. To give a little bit more clarification on the number of files, some of the clients were active at the time of Mr. Van Muren's resignation, and some were inactive, so they were prior clients. And in the process over the last couple of years, we had worked on getting an EHR. So some of our files were electronic and some were paper. So we did kind of an internal audit to determine, we went through every client we've ever had looking for every file that we need and are required to have per our ADHS license. So in doing that internal audit, we found files that had been missing from both active and inactive clients.
And was this system-wide or was this just for Mr. Van Muren?
We actually did it system-wide because, you know, you're gonna do all that work, you might as well find all the files that you need. But this table that we send to you is only for Mr. Van Muren's clients that he was responsible for.
And I guess the point of my question there is are the findings for Mr. Van Muren similar to the findings for the organization as a whole?
No, they are not. And for any additional files that we may have found missing, we were able to retrieve from our current clinicians. And the number of files that we found missing were specific to Mr. Van Muren.
I'd like to add something. I'm not sure that we know what Mr. Van Muren's claim is regarding the files. I don't think we've seen that. You said, Dr. Davey, I believe you said his number of files was far less than the 52 that we have.
I believe what I was saying, I believe that was the 10 supervisees he had. We'll let Mr. Van Buren or his attorney clear that up if I misspoke on that matter. So I may have crossed up the two of actual direct clients versus supervisees that he had.
Would you like me to address that?
If you just want to clear it up, that'd be great.
Yeah, so, and Brian can correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding was when he left in December, there were about 12 active people who he was either treating or supervising. I think almost all of them were supervising. Those 12 people were all discharged or treated or transferred to other people. I think 10 of them were, or 9 of them were discharged, and 3 of them were transferred to another therapist or another treating provider within the organization, the agency that he worked for. The 52, my understanding is, are almost all closed cases from past treatment or past services that have been provided by either Brian or that Brian supervised. So that's, I think, where the discrepancy you're talking about is. It was only 12 active on the day he left, but there were 52 other, I believe, all closed files that were comprised the Excel spreadsheet. That's my understanding.
And thank you, Dr. Davey and the board. Just to clarify, there were 12 active, 2 I transferred to Ms. Callahan, and the other 10 were ready for discharge. I found out through the supervisees that Ms. Callahan had advised them to keep them open for 30 days. And so they were slated for discharge, but not actually fully completed at my resignation.
Thank you, Brian.
And that kind of helps me with the other question of some of the dates that I'm seeing on the document that was provided by the complaints that really have a lot of 2019 dates and dates that are a little bit further back. So that helps me kind of correlate those two areas. I appreciate that. with regard, Dee Dee and Casey, to kind of operational systems within your company, you guys have obviously gone through audits in the past with other payers, including DED, including Access, whoever else, the MCOs you work with. Have any of these discrepancies, did they ever show up on audits? And who within the organization has kind of oversight, if you will, of kind of your compliance and audit programs?
Dr. Davey, members of the committee. We have been through previous audits. We, as members of the organization, shared in the responsibility of ensuring that client files were in order. I don't recall if any of these particular clients had been, these particular client files had been flagged in a previous audit. But we all did share in that responsibility as members of the company. Ms. Callahan, do you want to add anything to that?
We fortunately, or Dr. Davey and the committee, thank you. We fortunately have not had a formal audit since this has happened. I will say we have had some record requests from either referring agencies or health plans asking for client records that we do not have access to.
My question really goes back to the fact that some of these things are older, I'll just say, in terms of age. And, you know, those requests would have been going through, I would assume, closer to the time period where before the cases were closed, like in 2019, even 2020, and identifying that items were complete or ready to go, just trying to wrap my head around that process. I also have, I think in terms of that sheet, it's hard from my perspective to kind of understand what it means by not complete. Like, is it completely missing? Is it missing a signature?
Dr. Davey, I also may be able to provide some information on the audits if you want.
Not at this time. I think I'm good. When you guys have your response, that'll be good. Does anybody else have any further questions for DD or KC? I just have one question. At this point, are the matters resolved that led to this complaint?
Dr. Davey, members of the committee, one of the statements that was made earlier was that 10 clients, 12 clients active on the when Mr. Van Wyrten left. Two were transferred to Ms. Callahan and 10 were ready for discharge. Many things have been discovered since Mr. Van Wyrten resigned with regard to the transition. Because we were all partners, none of us supervised the other. And so we have no formal compliance committee or person who oversees all of our files. And so Mr. Van Merton's perception of ready for discharge was something that we discovered was not, some of those clients were not ready for discharge. They needed more, the clinicians needed more supervision to ensure that discharge was in the best interest of the clients. So there were things like that that have been discovered since then. Not necessarily violations, but definitely things that interfered with or a smooth transition. And that's essentially what we had been asking for, is sharing the files and extending and offering the consultant role to Mr. Van Merton was to ensure a smooth transition. So when we found some of those ready for discharge clients were not ready for discharge, there has been additional supervision for clinicians, additional work needed to ensure that the discharge was in fact the most appropriate thing. I'm not sure if that answered your question.
Yes, and one final question. Do you and KC believe that had the six-week transition gone to its entirety, that these matters would have been resolved?
In my opinion, that was sincerely our hope. Mr. Van Merton, Ms. Callahan and I negotiated that six-week transition specifically for that purpose. And so it was our hope that with more time, there would have been smoother transitions, better quality of care with regard to completeness of client files, appropriate transitions, that sort of thing.
And so this is going to be probably the toughest question for you, right? The tougher question is then, upon accepting, you know, his resignation early because of the discussion of renegotiating those terms, adding different things, you know, the miscommunications there of what was being asked. I mean, were you at that point, were you prepared to take the consequences that would go with that early resignation?
Speaking personally, I did not anticipate. I was not prepared. Yeah.
Casey, do you have anything to add before we move?
Thank you, Dr. Davey and the committee. I do not have anything to add. I'm in agreement with Dan.
Thank you. Any other board members? Yes, Ms. Shreves.
Thank you. Just a quick question. You've mentioned that for those that were discharged, that from your perception that they weren't ready. Can professionals have a different opinion on whether someone is ready to be discharged or not?
Dr. Davey, Ms. Shreve, yes. Professionals definitely can have differences.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Shreves. Mr. Gill, everybody's being so polite. Dr. Davis will not believe all the politeness.
I just wanted to follow up on Dr. Davies' remark about and going through this inventory. There are places where it says not completed, and I'm having to look at one. I don't want to identify it too specifically because we probably have to go into session for that. But you know, this is a case that was closed in 2019, and yet there's a info sheet that's not completed and a discharge summary that's not completed. This is one of the 51 files. So it kind of lends itself to what's going on here that that would lend itself to you know, not completing a file that's been terminated in 2019. Any comments?
Dr. Gill, members of the committee, it is a concern of ours, regardless when the client was discharged. If there is no discharge summary, then we haven't done our job.
And I mean, it sounds like it's an active case then, even though it's probably described as an inactive case. So our whole definitions have to be carefully looked at. When was this inventory created? Was it an ongoing creation or did you submit it at some point in time?
Ms. Callahan, would you like to address that?
Yes, thank you, Dr. Gill. This internal audit that I referred to earlier began after Mr. Van Meerten's resignation. I also want to add that it could be possible that these documents were completed, but Kaibab Behavioral Services no longer has access to them. So it could just be that the file is not in our possession any longer and once was, whether that be through our electronic health record system or our paper file. So it doesn't mean that it wasn't completed. It means it is not within our property.
Okay, thank you.
Can you elaborate on that? What do you mean it's not in your?
And can we confirm, is that because, can I just add on to that question? Can you also confirm is that doesn't mean it's necessarily Dr. Van Meeten's fault? Is that correct?
Mrs. Shreve and Dr. Davey, thank you. I cannot answer that. I'm not sure. I mean, when we did the internal audit looking for the documents, it's unclear, you know, if it's no longer in our possession and it once was, or if it wasn't completed. At the time of the audit, the file was not within our record system.
Dr. Davey, members of the committee, may I add a little to that?
Please.
I believe our correspondence, in our email correspondence, our text message correspondence provided an example of efforts that we put forth to try to find or recover missing documents, whether they were accidentally deleted, whether they were never created in the first place, we do not know. We simply were requesting Mr. Van Meerten's assistance in helping to find or recover those documents as soon as we realized what was missing.
And what year was the move to the new EHR or the EMR? Was that 2019? You see?
Dr. Davey, you are correct.
All right, I see other hands up from committee members. I'm sorry, yes, Dr. Caterina.
I'm not sure if you just addressed this because I don't know those acronyms, but if you've been through many other audits, wouldn't a case from 2019, wouldn't that have been picked up in the audit? There must have been some audit between 2019 and 2021. Like in other words, in the last audit, were those cases complete in the files? Mr. Danielson.
Dr. Caterina, Dr. Davey, Dr. Caterina, in our experience, audits sampled files. And in our preparation of audits and in our post correction of audits, we did in fact put forth effort in trying to ensure that files were complete. How it is that these files show up incomplete, I do not know. But in terms of the audits themselves, they sample files. They don't go through the full list of files.
But wouldn't you, like, knowing that you were having an audit, go through the files and double check that everything was in there so you would have a positive audit?
In my experience, the audits come with little preparation, little notice, 2 hours.
So there would not have been the kind of Excel spreadsheet you did for this meeting, where you have each patient and their forms. You would not have done that before.
Not in this format necessarily, but we have had many situations where we have reached out to clinicians and said, you know, let's take some time and get our files in order. Let's make sure that your files are complete, following up with clinicians. But it hasn't necessarily been in this format, in the spreadsheet.
So there's no, so that way you wouldn't know, because you had positive audits, right? You were not written up for having missing forms in your audits, were you, in the past? When the auditors came, did they bring to your attention that there were many incomplete files?
In my experience, no.
Okay. When you were all owners of the company, how did you establish the supervision of the techs or the other? Was that in a formal training agreement, or did it state who was responsible for the technician's work?
We have a referral process, and we assign a primary clinician and a supervisor in a document that is shared with both the supervisor and the clinician.
Were these students in an internship program, or they were independent? Or?
Some are there. First of all, they are all employees. Some are students, in fact, working towards their behavior analyst license. Some are not, but they all are supervised.
Okay. I was thinking that when the students completed, those that were students or those that were working towards their license, would their supervisors ordinarily go over the files that they worked on to be in their supervision meetings to assess that everything was correct and up to date and all papers that needed to be there were there? Would their supervisors look at that?
That was an expectation from my understanding. But not necessarily all of the time. We, as the members and the owners of the company and the licensed clinicians supervising others, we had regular conversations with each other about making sure files were in order, you know, in preparation for an audit when it might happen. And then it fell on the supervisors to follow up with the clinicians that they were supervising.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. A couple of questions. So there was a contract that was signed by all parties for 6 weeks of additional work. And then a resignation letter for 2 weeks was provided by Mr. Van Merton. And he said that the additional responsibilities were added as part of the reason for terminating early, I think. So were there additional responsibilities added, and what were those?
Dr. Davey, Dr. Meyer, are you asking myself and Ms. Callahan, or are you asking?
Yes. Dee and Casey, did you add or request additional work beyond what was agreed to in the 6 week contract?
We did not. Our text message and our email thread indicates that we did not add any additional responsibilities that weren't already part of what was laid out.
Okay. And in once you found the missing documents from your internal audit, did Mr. Van Merton have access to the electronic health record to attempt to resolve those missing documents?
He did not, but we made preparations for ways where if he was able to find those files on his computer, he could then upload them to our drive. We would share a folder with him. He could upload them to our drive. No, when he resigned, he no longer had access to the client files.
Okay. So after his resignation, do you feel that he attempted to work with you to fill in the missing documents, address those issues?
So this is a question of my opinion. What I'd like to say is that we attempted to work with him in many different ways, in many different combinations ways where we could collaborate and find a way to recover or find those missing documents. 83 days later, we still had no cooperation.
Can I interrupt then? Yes. The box of files was delivered after his resignation. Was that after the 83 days, or was that when did that occur in response to resignation?
I forgot the date.
It was December.
I believe it's about 6 days later.
Yeah,
six days following the resignation.
Okay. That's correct.
So I'm confused then, if you're saying he did not, after 83 days, he did not respond at all when he did provide some records. Was that only active cases, or what all was in the box?
There were paper files within the box, some of which were inactive cases. Some were still active cases. Some were files, partial documents of files that Mr. Van Merton was was seeing, the clients that he was seeing. We weren't honestly, we weren't necessarily sure whether they were still active or inactive. So we were trying to piece the pieces together. The 83 days began after we realized that there were missing documents. He did provide that box of paper files. Following that, as you read in our text thread and our email thread, there were many attempts to gain his cooperation to find or recover other documents.
So when did you conduct your audit?
Ms. Callahan?
Thank you, Dr. Davidson and Dr. Meyer. I wanted to add additionally, the box of documents that Mr. Van Meerten had dropped off at the office were in Mr. Van Meerten's possession in his home office because our office was at risk for flooding after the museum fire. So all of those client documents were removed from the office and housed in a locking cabinet at Mr. Van Meerten's home office to protect those files in case our office had flooded. So the box of documents that he had dropped off that day were many clinicians' documents or many clients' documents, not only his own. So it was after that we conducted the internal audit and found the 50 some odd files that you saw on the spreadsheet.
Okay, and did the box of documents, so it sounds like everybody knew that those documents were being stored in his home office. Were all of those documents that were removed then returned?
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. We sure hope so. But after the internal audit was completed, like we said, the spreadsheet indicates which files were still missing.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to clarify though, those documents are still missing, but it's been, I believe, DD's statement or yours, KC, that it's unclear whether that is completely on the licensee at this point. Like when it's unclear whether the documents were ever created or still in his possession or in the possession of another clinician, correct?
Thank you, Mr. Shearer, I believe that was you. We can confirm that it's not in the possession of another clinician or employee because we did check that first.
So it's either Mr. Van Meerten is keeping the files for his own personal use or they were not created, is what you're suggesting?
Thank you, Dr. Davy. I believe that is correct.
I'd like to add something. Another possibility is that they were destroyed either accidentally or intentionally.
Okay. Committee members. Yes, we'll finish Mr. Shreve and then Ms. Malott is waiting patiently. Dr. Malott.
Just really quickly, was there a list that sounds like doctor took him home for safety reasons because of potential flooding? Was there a list of what was in that box that went to his possession that went to his home?
Dr. Davy, Ms. Shreve, I don't believe we had a list.
So you don't know exactly what was in the box that he took home, so there's not any potential evidence of what was in there and, you know, he took it because of the potential flooding.
That is correct. We don't have evidence that there were documents that once existed and no longer exist. What we do know is the documents that need to be in each client's file. And we know who the clinician was and we know who the supervisor was.
And do you know did you talk to the clinician and ask him if they created those documents and now they're just missing?
Yes, we did.
All right, thank you.
Dr. Malott.
You know, my question was exactly what Ms. Shreve asked, if a list was created when the boxes went home so you know what went and then what came back. It sounds like things were done in a little bit of a hurry, and you know, especially with the threat of flooding. I will have questions for Mr. Van Merton when the time comes, but I'm not sure if we are ready to move to that yet. So.
Judging by no committee members' hands up, oh, Dr. Gill, one more for DDAC. Well,
it does sound like there's a lot of confusion here because of the perhaps the technical issues, and I'd like to just address Dr. DD and KC. Do you believe, with respect to your own patients, that you did not meet the standard of care regarding continuity of care, transitioning of patient care, and proper discharge, you know, perhaps due to the technical issues you are facing? Yes. So, I mean, did you meet those standards given the problems you are having with your technology? Were you properly discharging your cases? Did you have a sense of which cases were active and which inactive? And were you completing these and discharging these clients appropriately?
Dr. Gill, Dr. Davey, members of the committee, I believe that I was. I also believe that my eyes have been open since this situation and that I am more cautious and more careful now.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, committee members. And thank you, Dee Dee and Casey. Appreciate the additional insight around the complaint. Moving on, Mr. Van Nuren, you're present, and I understand your attorney is also present. Do you or your attorney wish to make a statement at this time?
Members of the committee, for brevity's sake, and given the in-depth summary that was already been provided, I think we would waive any sort of opening statement and move towards any questions you have. I would like to reserve the right to do a closing statement, depending on how things go, but I don't think we need to do an opening statement. I think the summary was provided and the materials have been, you know, the written materials have been, you know, distributed to the committee members.
Very good. Then I'm going to go to Dr. Malott. I thought she had some specific questions for Mr. Van Meeren. Dr. Malott, would you like to have those questions addressed?
So I just wanted to address the most recent thing that was raised when the boxes were taken to your home. Could you talk about how they were returned and, you know, just elaborate on that line of questioning?
Yes, we had made a decision due to floods and fire, in fact, to house the sort of inactive files in a fireproof safe at my house, which was the original address of Kaibab Behavioral Services, PLLC. We did not have a clinical space for about 4 months after establishing. So my house was designated as the business address. And therefore, we did house those files for 7 years in case of requests. And so that's where our process was typically to have the supervisor. In some cases, it was a original founding member that is no longer with Kaibab. Take the files, put them in a top drawer, and then periodically I would transfer them securely to a fireproof safe that's locked at the business address, which happened to be my house. And then about 3 business days after my resignation, that's where we had the texting correspondence for 4 days. I realized, well, we can't wait till Monday. Complaints really want the files now. So on Sunday morning is when we agreed to transfer the files at the office, at the clinical space, so that there would be, full access to anything that I might have in my possession. To my knowledge, I did provide them all of the business documents, the keys, any contracts that I had signed, as well as the client files in 2 different boxes. The large one was organized by client files, the smaller were, you know, bank account agreements and all of the business property.
Thank you.
Can you just elaborate on that last part? Do you today hold any client documents from your previous employment? Do you hold any documents from your previous employment that should be turned over to the complainants?
So in the complaint process was the first time that I had received any information about what documents specifically could not be found. And so per the advice of my attorney and counsel, I was, you know, advised to do a file recovery process through backups. And to right now I do have many of those files that I was able to recover. And so those would be the only ones. But at the time, before conducting a file recovery process and having any information about what documents were missing, I did not have any.
And those files that you just showed us, have those been turned over to DD and KC at this point? Or is that
something? Not at this point. It was the advice of my attorney to not have direct contact, and they have not been requested by complaints.
Yeah, in part of the supplemental responses we filed, we said we have the documents available upon request. I did advise Mr. Van Meerten not to contact the complainants directly or to try and provide anything to them. I didn't want to taint the investigative process. We did offer to turn those records over to the board. And if the board wants to turn them over to complainants, we have no objection to that. But at this point in time, I advise Mr. Van Meerten not to do that directly.
I have one question. So in terms of the file recovery process, who has access to that? Would the complainants also have access to do a file recovery to the system? Or is it only Mr. Van Meerten?
It's my belief that they should be able to access the files in various forms. I'm not sure what they've done so far to, other than ask the clinicians what they have and look at their EHR. So at this point, I believe they should have it, but I'm not exactly sure what's been done at this point.
Just to clarify, the backup recovery that Mr. Van Meerten did was to his personal computers.
Oh.
It was not to a system that,
that
the complainants would have access to. This was part of the dispute that happened was complainants asked him to basically turn over his computer. He said, no. They said, well, then we want to do a file recovery that only we have access to. He said, no, there's other files on there that you cannot view because of HIPAA. I have other clients that I've treated since I've left your organization that are on my personal computer. And at that point, there was a bit of a stalemate, for lack of a better term. Complainants would not back down that they and they alone should be able to review his personal computer. Mr. Van Meerten wouldn't back down that he should be the one to review what's on his computer and turn over anything that was related to KIBAB services. The complaint then gets filed, and my advice to my client was, at this point, don't do anything, don't give them anything, wait for the board to determine it. If you're providing the materials that they're requesting directly to them, it could be seen as interfering with the complainant's rights to file a complaint, that you're trying to influence the process. So I said, wait, let's hear what the board has to say. And if the board says, turn them over, we have no objection to that. But they did not have access to his computer, and that was kind of the stalemate that's happened, you know, up until the complaint was filed.
Okay.
Then I got to ask the question then, right? Do those files solve this problem? I mean, you've looked at what those files are. I mean, does that solve? I mean, maybe it doesn't solve all of them, but does it get to the point of the issue? Like, you were able to recover those through, I'm not going to say like you were able to recover them easily. Like, it sounds like it was an extraordinary measure to go through backup recovery and probably pay somebody to go through secure documents. But does that resolve the issue?
We attached a spreadsheet to our supplemental response, which went through all 52 files identified by the claimants. I believe, and again, Brian can correct me, I think we found most of the documents. And when I say most, I think it's 90%+. I think there were maybe one or two people who never signed up for services. There are no documents. There were a few other people where the contracts that were signed by KIBAB did not require the document that complainants claim is missing. So it does not exist, but it doesn't exist not because It wasn't supposed to have been generated and wasn't generated. It doesn't exist because it was never supposed to be generated in the first place. I want to say, and again, Brian can correct me, it's 90%+ that we were able to either find proof we did it, i.e. the form that he filled out on his computer. Some of them I think require the underlying clients who were receiving services to sign the acknowledgments or to sign off on treatment plans or other things. I don't know that we have those signed versions. What we have is the version that Brian created that he would have given to the client, that the client would have signed and given back to KYBAP. Again, once it leaves Brian's custody, we don't have a whole lot of information on why it isn't in KYBAP's files other than it's a problem on their end. And I don't say that lightly. I'm not trying to, you know, shift blame here. It's just we don't have access to their systems or their files to say what happened after that point. And frankly, if I heard Ms. Callahan earlier, I don't think they can answer that question. All they're saying is we don't have right now certain documents that we would expect to be in our file. I don't know that they have an explanation any more than we do as to why they don't. But what we can show and what we did show in the supplemental materials filed is that we were able to either locate the documents themselves, or we were able to locate the form of the document that Brian created that would have been given to the underlying client, or we were able to find an email transmitting it to KYBAP saying, here's the discharge summary for Mr. Shear or whoever it is. That doesn't mean that the pile Brian showed you has every single document that is in that claimant's claim is missing, but I think we've covered 90 something percent of them. Brian, would you agree with that?
I haven't done the math, but yeah, I think, and you know, again, sort of all of the documents are either very dated, a year or 2 years. So the coordination of care, you know, was provided at the time of you know, making the clients inactive or exiting them.
And I would point out at this point, as far as we're aware, and again, if claimants have additional information that was not part of the supplement they filed with the board, we're unaware of it, but we're unaware of any request from an underlying client that they didn't get a discharge summary or that they didn't get an evaluative report. We are unaware of any request from any referral source along the same lines that they didn't have it. It seems pretty obvious that if Brian was not generating, you know, these reports and providing them to the underlying clients, and those clients were, you know, discharged 3 years ago, you would have heard something from them in the 3 years hence. And there is none of that in the record.
I'm going to ask the obvious question. I want you to restate it. Those files, those can be put in possession of DD and KC overnight by middle of next week.
Just showed can be. I don't know how easy it's going to be to transmit them in an electronic format. I'm not a tech guy, I'm a lawyer. So I put the pile should easily be able to be submitted to either me and then to their counsel, or, you know, so whatever arrangements the board wants to make. But the short answer is yes.
In other words, you now have these in your possession, you're willing to give them back to the organization for which they belong.
Yes, we have no objection to that whatsoever.
Okay. And you're also saying, you know, maybe this doesn't answer every question, but this is the good faith effort that you were able to do through data recovery process.
Correct.
On your personal computer.
Correct.
Committee members. Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. Mr. Van Merton, the contract that you signed to work for 6 weeks after lists quite a few responsibilities seems fairly thorough to me. What are you saying were the additional responsibilities that led to you offering an immediate resignation?
So thank you, Dr. Davey and Dr. Meyer. As well, I'll reference the text messages from my resignation, but also my resignation email correspondence. On November 30th, complaints requested that we add the tax preparation process and calculating tax figures, which was not part of the original agreement. And a year's worth of tax preparation is quite lengthy. And so I have done it in the past for KYBAP as I was assigned by the original members, but it takes, you know, 2 weeks to get all that information and to provide the information to our accountant. And that's where I was not comfortable adding such significant tasks of tax preparation, tax calculations to the agreement.
Okay, so taxes, anything else?
That was the only significant task. There, well, I take that back. There were some additional, smaller additional tasks that I did agree to, I believe two. One was to explain to KC how to read a explanation of benefits or EOB report. That was not part of the original, but I did agree to add that on because that was a task that, you know, wouldn't take a significant amount of time. So I believe, yeah, that was one I did agree to.
Okay, well, the explaining bills and claims was part of the rule.
Mm-hmm. And so that could be where I just didn't understand. I thought that was through our clearinghouse. They asked me to go over a paper form, which I was, again, you know, there should be some correspondence that there's a record of, but I said, yes, that's fine. I can do that with the person in charge.
Okay. And then, so you had originally agreed to stay on for 6 weeks. Part of that was to continue providing supervision as well as direct clinical services. Is that correct?
At that point, I was not providing any direct clinical services. Anybody I was seeing that was active, I engaged in discharge planning actually probably a few weeks prior. And then just coincidentally was able to complete the discharge summaries. And again, you know, in reference to the question, were you know, things adequately exited? Following my resignation, I did complete two additional discharge summaries just to make sure that those members had adequate transition.
And okay, so were you planning on continuing to provide supervision for the full 6 weeks?
I was transferring supervision, so I would speak with the clinicians directly. And also, you know, if there was a supervisor such as Casey, we would have a meeting to discuss the transition, but not in the sense of like supervision towards BACB certification or treatment recommendations. It was more along the lines of transferring supervision and giving a warm handoff, which did happen for two of the clients that were remaining. And then again, the rest, I had reached out to the clinicians and in some cases had meetings with the clinician and the parents to identify the remaining 10 members. And so that's where that information came right from the clinicians or the parents that they were ready for discharge. Now, sometimes in the fields, you know, people change their minds. Parents might say, oh, but now we want to work on this. And so that could be the case, but I was unaware of any of that. I was just made aware of these are per clinicians, per the parents, these clients are completing services.
Okay, thank you. Those are all my questions.
Other committee members? Okay. Back to my lovely script, right? I think at this point, hearing no other comments from committee members or complaints or Mr. Van Muren or council, are you guys good?
I would add one, just a brief kind of some supplemental information from the questions asked of the complainants. We talked about some audits. There were three audits conducted by DHS, one in 2018, one in 2019, one in 2020. All were error-free or deficiency-free. I'm happy to provide those records to the committee, or you know, you can take it upon the proof of my saying so. but yeah, it's called an offer of proof legally. I don't know if anyone wants to go down that road, but I would offer that there were three audits done. All of them were deficiency free. It's my understanding that there were also internal audits done over that time period. I obviously don't have access to those audits or their results. I believe they were all deficiency free as well, but complainants would be able to address that more directly than I would. I want to emphasize that when Brian dropped off the boxes of documents in front of the office door. He waited to see that Mr. Danielson showed up in his car, got out of the car and was walking into the building before he left. It's not like he just showed up at 8:57 and left them unattended. He waited for, you know, one of the complainants to show up and start to enter the building. I don't believe the documents were left unattended for more than a minute, 2 minutes, something along those lines. But I did just want to kind of clarify that. Again, it's my understanding that of the 12 people that were still being supervised by Mr. Van Meerten on the day he resigned, all of them were discharged within 30 days. I don't believe any additional services were required for those people, but again, complainants would be able to better address that. But my understanding is all of them were, except for the two that were transferred to Ms. Callahan. I believe the other 10 were all discharged within 30 days. I don't believe there's any continuation of care issues here. Again, no underlying clients have indicated that they had any problems with the work Mr. Van Meerten did when he did it, or that records weren't created by Mr. Van Meerten when he created them. We have, like I said, circumstantial evidence that all of those records were generated, were maintained, were properly transmitted to CIBAB. And again, we seem to just have this, you know, black hole of something seems to have happened to either the medical record, the electronic files, or the PARD files, if they were done that way, after they left Mr. Van Meerten's custody. Like I said, I don't believe there's any transition of care issues here. I don't believe there's any maintenance of records issues. I would, you know, ask the committee to you know, close this matter.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, was there a question for me?
Yes, I don't know who wants you or BVM want to answer. The meeting was set for 9 a.m. on Monday to bring the box of files. I read the email exchanges. So then in the next response and text, DD said, well, you're not here or something to that effect. And then BVM says, well, I have a meeting at night on the other at 9 o'clock on the other side of town. So if there was a meeting scheduled at 9 on the other side of town, why didn't you meet at 8:30 or 8:45? So then the box of files could have been given personally to DD. So
just to clarify, so the meeting we agreed on was 9 o'clock on Sunday. I proposed Monday being the next business day, but Sunday is what we needed to do. And so when I showed up at the clinical space, I verified that nobody was in the building. It was completely empty, that all the doors were locked before even transferring the files over. And then two points. One, you know, that was, I believe, December 6th or 5th. And so, you know, that was when COVID was really resurging. And so I had reservations about COVID. And, you know, to the point of the clinical office, it's a very old building from the 50s. There's no ventilation. And so I had reservations about COVID. But I'll be honest, after everything with the me being a sort of an instrumental and essential member of founding CIBAB, and then being voted off, and then being asked to engage and commit to significant additions to the contract, I was hurt. And, you know, I say that honestly, I was hurt. I didn't really feel like seeing complaints in person. And so that's why I brought the box in, waited until they arrived and verified the building was empty before leaving. And then again, Sunday mornings in Flagstaff in the winter, I didn't schedule it for any earlier because you can actually get across town within 5 to 10 minutes. And that's, you know, a reason I didn't consider worrying about traffic or, you know, having to get across.
There was no way that if you were going to meet at 9, that you could be in the other place in Flagstaff at 9.
Well, the meeting was flexible, so I should mention that, you know, being 10 minutes late wasn't imperative.
But you could, and also you could have, I know it's cold there, but you could have waited a little bit to actually maybe be 5 feet away, to actually saw each other, greeted each other 5 feet away and said, there's the box, you know.
Again, that's where I just was really hurt and really wasn't up for that on an, you know, emotional level. And, you know, with the empty building and me watching complaint Davidson pull up, that's where I was certain that there would be nothing that could happen to the files in that meantime.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everyone. All right, I'm gonna go ahead and make a motion to move to an executive session as I need legal advice on one question. Is Ms. Galvin, there she is.
Is that a motion?
That was a motion. I need a second.
Second.
You need a vote.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion, any opposed? Motion carries. Board staff, do your magic. I don't know who's got control today. So now is a time for deliberation, right? So we're getting discussion, deliberation of this matter. This is a time for board members to exchange their thoughts on the matter. And then we will move from that discussion to deliberation, hopefully to a motion. So as the lead, I think I'll kick off the discussion, and I'll kick off the discussion with one that I have, you know, the utmost respect for both Mr. Van Muerten and the complaint DD and KC, as I know them within our practice community. I will also say that I've been a partner to not fun breakups professionally in my career, as well as you know, just difficulties with potential that were partners, that were friends, that were colleagues. And I think I'd be remiss if I did not say this for the record to both of you, that it pains me to see us in this position. And, you know, I do hope, as I've read through several of the text messages, that was both of your wishes back in December, that once this matter is done, that we can all move forward, that you two can move forward in a collegial fashion. With that being said, in terms of the discussion, you know, I see this in two different segments. I see the issue of this being an employment matter where you have an individual who's agreed to a contract as, you know, in the view of one person not abiding by the contract, in the view of another one, it's being modified without consent, even with some discussion and some minor modifications being allowed, and that leading to an early resignation and therefore some duties that were remiss in the final 4 weeks of the agreed upon contract. I also see on the business side that, you know, the organization as a whole was, I'll just say, probably not up to par in terms of its record keeping at its inception. It sounds like that has been something that has been focused on by the current partners to clean up. Again, a business matter that, you know, the organization piece of it, you know, leads to some of this distress in terms of when you're trying to put files back together, make sure things are there, make sure you've got all of the information that's coming from someone that has held a lot of that information over the years because of his position as founder and member. That piece aside is not something that understanding is something that the board will get involved in. The piece that I was interested in hearing about today was around case files, the exchange of the box of information from Mr. Van Muerten to the complainants, and any continuity of care concerns that actually occurred versus ones that might have occurred in 19 or 20 due to records that could not be found in 2021. And so, you know, with that, like I understand that the box, difficult to see someone you're in a fight with. you know, I understand what you're saying, Mr. Van Muerten, that may not have been something you were looking forward to in terms of having to have an exchange, and that, you know, in your mind, that watching him get there and grab the box was enough to make you feel at ease. I also understand from the, you know, the other side of, like, that was sensitive material, could have led to issues that arise from the HIPAA violation or, you know, some other thing that could have happened during those 3 minutes. I think that that's, you know, in my estimation, that that time lapse was probably minimal. I don't think there was a huge, you know, this impending threat to the protection of the public by that action. I do think that, you know, at some point, hopefully the two of you will be able to interact and put this behind you. The second piece has to do with all the client files, right? The ones that we saw, 52 items that are missing. That is distressing to me. However, I am unsure that it is Mr. Van Meerden's fault, for lack of a better word. It appears that he has some of the documents that may or may not be missing, that he provided, that, you know, the documents that were available to him at the time were not withheld in malice. And I'm of the belief that those documents should be turned over immediately, either council to council, however you want to do it, and get those in the possession of the organization and have those completely removed from your system. And really, that's where I stand as the lead on this. I'd like to hear from my other committee members.
Dr. Davey?
Yes, Dr. Moore.
I think you've done an excellent summary of all of the issues, and I appreciate you sharing your own reactions to the situation. And I have nothing further to add, but I just wanted to express my appreciation of your very thorough summary and the questions you asked. I'm so glad we have a behavior analyst on our committee.
Dr. Meyer.
Thank you. I think I'm in agreement with what you're laying out, Dr. Davey. I see poor management of records across the board. It does seem like that's trying to be addressed by all parties. And I don't know that there's evidence that there's any violation on Mr. Van Meerden's part, but agency-wide and all three parties here, I think, need to improve record keeping and policies for maintaining a what's the word I'm looking for? Just the documentation of where the records are and who has them and where they're being stored. I don't see an issue with abandonment of clients or responsibilities. It sounds like Mr. Van Meerden tried to address those issues with who he was working with or supervising. And then finally, I don't understand why they've been sitting on those records for who knows how long. They need to immediately be turned over to the agency. And just moving forward, much more efforts on record keeping. So,
other committee members, Ms. Shreves.
Now I was just going to make a motion unless someone else was.
Feel free to make a motion.
I make a motion that that we dismiss this case, but however, based on that the files that are in possession of Dr. Van Meer get transferred within 5 business days. And that proof of that occurring is sent to the board.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, your motion is that the complaint be dismissed contingent upon the records that Mr. Van Meerden has in his possession today.
Correct. And we need proof of within 5 business days and proof of exchange.
Dr. Meyer.
I think that in other cases, when we've found that there are documents missing and records aren't complete, that's a violation. I mean, of record keeping. And so And I don't know that that all falls on Mr. Van Merton, but on all parties here that were involved in that agency, records were mismanaged. So that's my concern about just dismissing, is that this is multiple parties that were not managing records correctly.
So I hear what you're saying. I think what my concern was is that it was Casey was saying that because they took over, they're not sure from a record standpoint when they came in the history of a lot of it. So there seems as though I would agree there are some record issues. I don't know though. You're right. All three are responsible for it. Is it enough right now? They appear, I think what they said is they appear to have most of the records. This and Dr. Van Morten will provide what he has. Obviously going forward, they need to have excellent records, but you know, I guess in the bigger sense, if we felt strong enough, we could put a, you know, issue with all three of them.
Well, and
but it seemed to be convoluted in regards to where they even knew where the records are when they came in. And this seems, I'm not sure.
Well, but they've been there for a while. The complainants are not brand new,
right,
to this agency. And I found it interesting that Mr. Van Merton's attorney said that there have been DHS audits and there were no issues found up to 2020. So to all of a sudden say we're missing tons of records, I don't see how that couldn't have been discovered in an audit. So it's...
This is Dr. Malat. I think the agency does have some work to do. Based on the specific complaint you're receiving, we have a motion made by Dr. Mishri, and I would urge that the complainants as well as the complainant the work on really solidifying they're all responsible members of this profession. In fact, some of them are the founding members and are well aware of all of the issues and need to do due diligence and come up with a system where, especially when this transfer of records from agency to agency, that they continue to work on it. And, you know, so we don't hear these types of issues at our board meeting. So I don't know if you had a second, but, you know, I would add my second to your motion.
All right, so we have a first and a second that can move us into discussion. Dr. Gill.
I just wanted to touch on what Dr. Malat is saying, and maybe I have a question. Is there a role for the board to play in insisting that this agency clean up their act with respect to their documentation record keeping and to get maybe a follow-up report or something to ensure that they're moving in the right direction and that we're monitoring the situation, because we are supposed to be defending the public. And I think this is a disservice to the public. I think Dr. Meyer is correct. It's a disservice to the public when you have an agency in which their record management is clearly below standard.
So I think that's probably outside the purview of this particular complaint, and I would, you know, have Ms. Galvin opine on that. I think the matter is, like, if there is that concern, then we can address that in a different way. Outside of this complaint, I don't think we can ask the agency to, you know, in 60 days tell us what they've done to clean up their record report. I think that would have to be in a different sort of fashion and not as part of today's issue. Dr. Meyer.
So, and I agree with that. I think that if we were to look at anything with the agency, it would mean we'd need to open a complaint and go through that discovery. I think there's, just in dealing with the complaint against Mr. Van Merton, this is just a complaint screening review, right? Am I correct on that?
Correct.
And so, we're not, I think in the past, am I right in saying that at the level of the complaint screening committee, we've said, we've offered a non-disciplinary letter of concern and not proceeded. Is that, have we done that?
Yeah, we I think, oh, I don't know about that.
Ms. Galvin?
Yes, you could. In a, the alternative of dismissing it, you could offer a letter of concern for any perceived conduct. And then if that is not signed, it would be moved to the next level.
So I have concerns with just in everybody's responsibility for record keeping. I think there's an issue here. I also think that there's been efforts on both sides to try to remedy it. So I guess I'd like to offer an alternative motion, but I probably can't do that yet.
Can you, can you amend it?
You can maybe amend it.
So can you make a second?
We have a second.
We have, Ms. Galvin, can he amend it?
I'm actually very comfortable with this motion. I think they need to go work on it. I really don't see a need to change the motion. So,
Ms. Shreve, you were the one that made the motion. So unless the individual who moved rescinded their motion as well as the second, then we have to vote on this motion before we can entertain a subsequent or second motion.
But can we not entertain an amendment?
Yeah, we...
You could entertain an amendment, but this is a motion to dismiss.
There's So I will withdraw my motion. Can I do that?
Yes.
And then, but Dr. Milot would have to agree to that. Is that correct?
I think we need to go through with the motion.
Okay.
So let's call the vote. Call the question. Would you like a roll call for this?
Yes, for the reason that I'm not certain where we're going to land. So the motion is to dismiss the complaint.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Contingent.
Hold on one second. Mr. Diner's hand is up. I may have missed that prior to the roll call of this. So could he please interject if he would like?
Yes, sorry. Thank you. My question is not in regards to the motion to dismiss, but in regards to the letter of concern idea that was floated. My question is, instead of offering a letter of concern, can we issue a letter of concern? Thank you.
It's an initial review, so I'll let Jean clarify that.
Yeah, that's correct. Not at this stage of the proceedings, you cannot offer, or you cannot issue a letter of concern.
Because it's an initial.
I believe the statutes say at the initial review, a letter of concern or non-disciplinary CE order can be issued.
Thank you. That answers my question.
But this is an initial review, right?
It is.
Yes, it is.
It is. That's how the item is. So it's okay. To the full board.
Ms. Galvin's looking. We're just double checking.
Okay.
While she's looking, I feel your concern. And so, as we move beyond this initial complaint, then maybe we can revisit some options that we have.
We call the question.
You may, and I apologize. I have too many boards. You may issue a letter of concern at this point, but we do have a motion on the table for a dismissal contingent upon the exchange of records.
I'm sorry, Ms. Galvin, what is that statute?
32-2081 H. No, I'm sorry.
I believe it's under J.
J. J.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm just going to clarify where we're at because I've lost track of motions and withdrawing of motions, but I believe that the motion to dismiss is still on the table. Ms. Shreve made the motion, Dr. Milot made the second, and so we're going to call the question right now with the roll call. Ms. Pacanon or
Ms. Poe?
Ms. Poe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Davey?
Yes.
Dr. Meyer?
No.
Dr. Catarino?
Yes.
Mr. Dinar?
Yes.
Dr. Gill?
No.
Ms. Lebo, excuse me, Dr. Malat?
Yes.
Ms. Shreve?
No.
The vote is 4 yeses, 3 noes. Motion to dismiss carries.
Thank you. So with regard to this complaint, these matters are closed. Ms. Galvin, given some further discussion, do we need to add that to a future agenda, or can we have some discussion now since it's related to this matter?
If a board member wants to add an additional item to a future agenda, they may make that recommendation or request at this time.
Committee members?
I don't know if I want to, I mean, to...
I'll just say this. I think we're going to find what we just found, right?
Right. So to dismiss this one, mm-hmm. I don't have any main agenda items.
So my question would be, I guess, like, you know, we can't offer any letter of concern. The parties are on this call, right? The parties are, you know, still licensees under this board. But I will say what I'm hearing from Dr. Meyer and I think several others on the committee is that there is concern here, and that you know, we are concerned for the public's sake, and that has come out during these proceedings, and that essentially on the radar of the board, right? And that's a real difficult spot to be in at this point. And so some of these things are going to have to be rectified on your end. I don't know that there's much we can do as a board, but if something comes across our plate again in terms of record keeping from the organizations or the individuals, then, you know, then it's not going to most likely go the way that this one went down. I don't know how else to capture it, Dr. Meyer. I know you're sitting there too, trying to figure out how to encapsulate it without this
off. I am satisfied with your wording of that. Thank you.
Yeah. And Dr. Davies, if I can add just a reminder to both parties, my motion also included an exchange of the files within 5 business days, and we need, and the board needs to have receipt of that.
We'll make arrangements to have those deposited with counsel for the complainants.
All right, thank you.
And both parties can contact me regarding that.
Thank you.
And so I will just say that failure to make that happen within 5 days would request the board staff put this matter back on a future agenda.
And you are referring to 5 working days, right?
Yeah, I said business days, yeah.
I would assume by next Friday.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yes. All right.
Thank you very much. Board members, that's going to move us back to number 13, 14, new agenda items for future meetings.
We did that.
But Dr. Davis Wilson asked me to revisit it. And so I'm only following the captain's orders. Nothing else? All right. Hearing no other things to add to future meetings, 15, our favorite item, adjournment. Do I have a...
I make a motion to adjourn.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you very much, board staff, for keeping us organized. Thank you very much to the participants, and of course, to all committee members and board members. Appreciate your presence and hard work today.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Dr. Davies, great job.
Thank you.